Studio 360.
Floor lava.
Red
Rovers
and Jakey
Rideover.
Tiger.
Run.
Gavin, run away from him now. Run away. Don't let that boy get you.
And now, cried Max, let the wild rumpus start.
This hour on Studio 360, we are talking about how children play and the power of unscripted make-believe for kids. So first, forgive me this brief Andy Rooney-ish rant, but back in the day, more of us really were free-range children. As a middle school kid, I'd leave the house for hours with no particular destination in mind and no pre-approval from my parents, alone or with pals, wandering, imagining, inventing games, getting filthy, getting spooked sometimes. I experienced a sense of freedom on those outings that I wouldn't have if my mom and dad had me on the cell phone leash. And I think, as a result, I'd be a less interesting and resilient adult.
I am approaching the wall of blocks to climb up it to get to the slide. There's a bunch of children.
Wow, it's so long!
That is Paul. We're out on Governor's Island, this 172-acre park in New York Harbor, tucked between Manhattan and Brooklyn, accessible only by ferry.
I am waiting in line behind some crazy people. Now, I have a piece of cardboard to make me go faster down the slide, but I'm not talking to you.
We can see the Statue of Liberty over there to the west, and you can hear the helicopter tours flying overhead. We're in a section of the island called the Hills, and Paul is giving us a firsthand account of what it's like to go down this zigzaggy 57-foot-long slide, which is the longest slide in New York City.
I'm placing my cardboard on the slide. I'm getting on the slide. And I'm going. That's all from Paul's slide.
You may have guessed that Paul's not one of our radio professionals. He's 10, and he's got a sister cavorting nearby, Romy, who is 7. Paul and Romy's mother is Alexandra Lang. She's an architecture and design critic whom I've known since I was an architecture and design critic years and years ago. And she's the author of the excellent new book, The Design of Childhood. Her book looks at 5 different realms of design as they concern children. Toys, the home, schools, cities and towns, and the playground. One of her favorites is this place, practically brand new, the Slide Hill on Governor's Island.
We're sitting by Slide Hill, which is kind of topography and playground combined into one. And it has 4 slides. One of them is the longest slide in New York City, but they're made part of the landscape. It isn't like a slide on a playground that's plastic and over that squishy stuff. You can get up to them all different ways, on rocks, on wood, on paths, and there's a grove of trees around them that will eventually shade them.
Governor's Island was a military base for more than 2 centuries, but over the last dozen years, it's been transformed into this eccentric and really wonderful public park with 19th century buildings and picturesque walks and rolling hills and cultural events, all of it 10 or 15 minutes across the water from the city proper.
The Trust for Governor's Island hired the Dutch landscape architecture firm West 8, led by a man named Adriaan Huize. And their proposal was to create topography, was to create hills to, among other things, give people an amazing view of the Statue of Liberty.
So, what is so great about this particular playground?
I feel like it really gives kids a little bit more of a nature experience, even though we're in an urban environment and even though, you know, this was designed by a landscape architect, because you have that feeling of like running up a hill, almost like you have when you're sledding and you can sled down whoosh, but then it's a little bit of a labor to get back up the hill. So it kind of works kids harder. They have to figure out their own route, and there's just like more parts of the experience are fun and more parts of the experience are play.
And you know, it's kind of dangerous looking, right? I mean, these great big, roughly quarried rock stones. You know, you climb up to get to the top of the slide. I mean, it probably isn't dangerous, but it looks rougher and more adventurous.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and it is somewhat more adventurous. One of the things that developmental psychologists have started to talk about in terms of children's play is how if children are always given a slide and a ladder to the slide that has the same distance between the rungs and is optimized for easiest climbing, they don't learn the climbing skills that they used to, and they don't learn the climbing skills that you get in this kind of variation where you can go up a path or you can go up, you know, boulders, or you can go up a kind of wooden Jenga-ish section. So kids need to have the opportunity to make those decisions, like what can I do and what's hard now and what's going to be easier later. And there's enough variation in what's given to them to play on that they can have that feeling of mastery and that there's another challenge ahead of them.
Right. And there are four slides here, I guess, of yeah. ascending difficulty.
Yeah, yeah. There's what my kids would now call a baby slide. There's some, you know, in-between slides. And then there's this really big slide. So now with the baby slides, they run up it. And they would never go down it because that's not fun anymore. But, I mean, you see, there are kids that are just going up and down and up and down over and over and kind of hollering as they come down because it's really fast. That's the other benefit of the metal slides. They do get hot. You know, you do have to be mindful of that, but you can go so much faster than you can on a plastic slide.
And again, it's built into this hill, and the hill has, you know, wild grasses and trees. It's again, we are in the middle of New York City. It's a designed park, but it's a suggestion of wildness.
Yes. Yeah, and that's definitely part of the design strategy that West 8 put in out here. I mean, it's a wildflower garden. It's wild grasses. Everything has been optimized to deal with a kind of a salty climate because there's salt spray from New York Harbor all around it. And so the idea is that you can lose yourself a little bit in the landscape the same way you can, you know, kind of lose yourself in play.
For her kids, it's not entirely play. They also do recon for her.
We've been going to a lot of playgrounds and like play testing them for her to write, so she can write about them in her book or getting some type of toy that she can write about.
Uh-huh. Does she pay you for that work? Because it sounds like you're doing research, really.
No.
No.
No?
She doesn't. I wish.
So, Alexandra, when did playgrounds show up? When we kind of invented the idea of childhood?
Well, yes, there's a lot of debate about when, let's say, modern childhood was invented. But in terms of
1883, okay.
No, in terms of playgrounds, they first came to Boston in the 1880s. Some of the women who ran settlement houses in Boston saw what were called sand gardens in Germany, which were basically like a vacant lot filled with sand that would be installed in an urban setting, often in the summer when kids were out of school and needed something to do. So she brought this idea to Boston and put a sand garden in a poor neighborhood, and it was a big hit. And so the settlement houses began to see that as part of their agenda, you know, helping immigrant families, they also needed to help the children and give them a place to be, a place to play that wasn't the streets. And so the sand gardens then in the early part of the 20th century led to public parks that had playgrounds with actual equipment, you know, often metal equipment. Some of those parks would have a park house. They would have exercise classes. There was really a whole charity movement towards play and getting children active in cities as a way of often of keeping them from, dirty tricks.
Well, right. And there, if your whole thing is playgrounds of a certain design sort, you fall into the problem that urban renewal people fell into in the 50s and 60s that Jane Jacobs had to say, wait, stop. It's okay as it is. Don't tear it all down and make it a big tower. Stickball is good.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And actually, it was funny. So, I mean, the playgrounds that a lot of people, I would say, especially baby boomers, probably grew up with, had metal structures over asphalt. And, you know, you really very rarely see those anymore. But I went up to Van Cortlandt Park to the Cloisters with my family recently, and we ran across one of those climbing structures that was probably put in by Robert Moses in the 1940s, just a metal three-dimensional grid.
Jungle gym.
Yes, a jungle gym, classic jungle gym. And of course, my kids went nuts for it. And I took a picture and posted it on Twitter, and I got like 200 responses because there's an amazing sort of waves of nostalgia when people see childhood objects. And you really don't, like, I mean, that jungle gym should be in a museum. Like, it is an important piece of design. There isn't so much wrong with it. I mean, I know because I've done this reading why they got rid of jungle gyms over asphalt. But on the other hand,
because what kids knocked their heads on against the bar and
yeah, in the early 1980s, they put in a series of safety regulations in response to a set of lawsuits for, among other things, kids falling off the top of slides sideways. And they really focused on the distance of falls because that was where kids broke their arms or, you know, in more terrible cases, broke their skulls. So that's why you almost never see play equipment now that's not over wood chips, sand, or those squishy tiles that we have on most of the New York City playgrounds. And that's also why most climbing structures don't go straight up and down. Like, from the top of one of those jungle gyms, you could fall straight down for 6 or 7 feet. And if you look at climbing structures today, they're designed so that if you fall, you're likely to hit something else on the way down that you can grab onto. So you don't have that kind of straight shot down. These are smart things. Like, we don't want children to get hurt.
Yes.
But on the other hand, I think now we've gone too far and children aren't getting hurt, but they're also not being challenged, and then they don't want to go play.
Right. Again, speaking of my baby boomer youth, are there still merry-go-rounds, which in retrospect probably were kind of dangerous?
And, I was definitely afraid of that.
And teeter-totters or seesaws?
Well, that kind of equipment, what do they call it? They say it requires a larger fall zone. So you have to have a larger area of soft surfacing material around a merry-go-round in case kids, you know, let go and spin out. And as playgrounds get compact, as people start thinking about maintenance, they want to group all of the equipment closer together. They can get more on the playground pad if they don't have equipment that requires that larger fall zone. So they take out merry-go-rounds and seesaws. But in fact, those merry-go-round and seesaws have important effects for physical development. There's something called the vestibular system, which is your inner ear, which is about balance. And so kids need to have that challenged in order for it to develop. So they need to be able to spin. They need to be able to run, you know, like run across the seesaw and let it slowly.
They're like physics experiments,
yeah,
too, right?
Exactly. So they don't have the opportunity to use spinny things, and that makes their balance develop more slowly.
And so in the overregulated nanny states of Europe, they have more of those things?
They do have more of those things. One of the things I was interested in was, you know, why do all the playgrounds in Brooklyn look the same? Like, oh, we're in this new neighborhood, let's go check out the playground. But, oh, that's the same piece of equipment, just with different colors. So it turns out the Parks Department orders things from about 3 different company catalogs because that equipment has already been means tested and they know it's up to standard. But so I called one of those companies, Compan. And I talked to a woman who heads up their research department there, and I was like, you know, why isn't the equipment more challenging? And she said, oh, no, we've read all the studies about risk and what, you know, how kids need risk and spins and all of that. And actually, you know, we have all this equipment that nobody, like parks departments in America won't order, you know. So Compan Parks in Sweden, say, are ordering from a different part of the catalog, and she sent me to YouTube to look at videos of these things that spin around and have ropes off the end with like a little seat on it, so kids can spin each other and they spin out. It's almost like, you know, a carnival ride.
But in risk-taking America, we don't have that.
They don't order it. Like, it's in the catalog.
Because they're worried about liability.
They're worried about liability because the fall zone is very wide for something like that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, she was kind of saying, don't blame the catalogs.
Right. And as a mother, do you ever, I mean, you get, of course, why parents, you know, don't want their kids to break their arms or worse.
Yes.
But are you ever, like, as you have become an ideologue for risk, are you ever torn?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's hard to let your kids go. You want them to be independent. You want them to have their own minds. But then you see them, you know, up, you know, on a big rock in Van Cortlandt Park, and you think, you know, is she going to fall? Like, does she know what she's doing? And that's hard. But if you don't let your child take that risk, they don't get the reward of the satisfaction of getting up that rock.
Couldn't agree with you more. One sees some playgrounds, contemporary playgrounds, where, you know, instead of just a jungle gym, it's a rocket ship, or it's instead of a slide, it's a dinosaur.
Yeah.
Which always seems a little cheesy to me. Those are controversial, right?
Yes.
In your fancy design world.
Yes, I agree. It's cheesy. No, it's just not necessary. I mean, kids, it goes back to, you know, kind of cardboard box play even. Like, why tell a kid, like, what the box is? Why tell a kid what the climbing structure is? Let them decide what it's going to be that day. And if you put little wings and a point on it and say it's a rocket ship, then, I mean, they can ignore it, but they may only feel that they can play a space game in that piece of climbing equipment. And who needs that? I mean, that in a way seems to me to be kind of subscribing to some adult idea about like what kid things look like, and kids are fine with abstraction. Like their imagination fills in the blanks.
Yeah, you in the book create this typology of the sort of forces at play in playground design, and the abstractionists being one of them.
So the abstractionists are people like Osamu Noguchi, the sculptor, who, it turns out, spent about 60 years of his art career trying to build a playground that kind of, again, looks like abstract sculpture.
As his furniture and his lighting do, too.
Yes, yes. So he started designing them in the 1930s, and they were quite influential because they were exhibited at MoMA. They were in all the magazines. A lot of important people like Thomas Hess, who was the editor of Art in America at the time, backed them, but he couldn't get one built in New York. He tried and tried. There's one Noguchi playground in Piedmont Park in Atlanta, and I went on a journey to Sapporo in the north of Japan to see his last work, which was the one place that a really giant Noguchi playground was made. And that has, it has pyramids, it has slides that look like mountains, all of these things that are just really aesthetically beautiful, but are also challenging play experiences. I mean, it was a bit tragic that I couldn't bring my children with me because of school and expense, but I played on all of the play equipment by myself in Japan. And it was pretty awesome.
Should we get Paul and Romy back and see?
Sure.
And get there.
Yeah, I see Romy right here.
Okay. Romy, Paul.
Hello.
So you've been coming here your whole lives?
Basically, yeah.
Pretty much.
But these slides and this playground were here when you were little, right?
No. They're very new.
Yeah, they're pretty new.
Made it a couple of years ago. They, like, completely, like, there's a couple hills and they completely made them these little mountains of fun.
And is it different than just going to a playground in Prospect Park?
Yes. Something?
How so?
I just feel like there's a lot of more wildness. Like, there's that whole hill over there.
Yeah. Like wildness, like actually scary or just more fun?
It's more overgrown.
Just more fun.
There's a lot more plants, and it's less kind of like trimmed down with like cobblestone sidewalks
right.
And more crazy.
Yeah. Do you go to playgrounds elsewhere?
Yes,
definitely.
Yeah.
And what do you like on those playgrounds?
There's this one playground down in Pier 6 that has like a sphere climbing structure. It's really cool.
How about you, Romy?
Well, there's also this park in Pier 6 that only has swings that I like.
Thanks for talking to me.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
And Alexandra, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alexandra Lange's terrific new book, The Design of Childhood, is just out.
Zoe Saunders and Tommy Bazarian produced that story.